Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Eric Olson, owner of Permaculture Artisans, an ecological design installation firm, as well as a licensed contractor in California. He is also a permaculture teacher who began teaching in 2001. He was suggested as a guest on the Facebook page for the show, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. If you'd like to suggest a guest, that's a great place to do so. You can find requests there from me from time to time for who I should reach out to for an interview. If there's anyone you'd like to hear on the show, let me know there. After reading Mr. Olson's biography on his company website, the suggestion to interview him was a natural fit because of the work he's doing to make permaculture a viable career option. As one of my desires as an instructor and podcaster is to provide a meaningful way forward for students and listeners so we can show how permaculture works to a broader world, being able to have a permaculture job, whatever your specialty, is vital. Eric is someone who is making that happen, and he's sharing it with us through this interview and through his work building the Permaculture Skills Center. That center forms the framework for our discussion. In this episode, beyond the normal introduction to Eric and his work, we also talk about professional permaculture, the need for a strong work ethic, including ensuring that our word is our bond, and developing working economic models to show how permaculture can be a viable career path. After you listen to this interview, if you'd like to find out more about Mr. Olson, where he's teaching, or Permaculture Artisans, you can do so through the links in the show notes. If you find this conversation, or any in the archives, valuable, please consider making a donation to the show. It's been a little over a year since I relaunched, and nearly 3 years since the show first began, and it's with your assistance that I can keep it on the air and continue to make the numerous investments behind the scenes to improve the quality and possibility for recording interviews in person and in a round table discussion format. Find out how you can help by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. In the meantime, here's the interview with Eric Olson. I'll join you afterwards with a few thoughts and updates. Then, Eric, if you're ready, could you give us a bit of your background and how you came to permaculture and the work you're doing now?
Yes. So I came to permaculture when I was 19 years old. A group of friends and I got together in response to what we started to learn about genetically engineered seeds and some of the things going on with Monsanto and the Terminator seed technology. Actually really turned on this group of young folks, and we started a nonprofit to give gardens away and save heirloom open pollinated seeds. So that was the beginning for me at the age of 19. And in that process, I found permaculture. And some of our local mentors here in Northern California sort of took us under their wing. And that began my journey of learning permaculture design, becoming a permaculture teacher, and a permaculture activist. So I'm 34 now, so I'm closing in on nearly half my life and my entire adult life in the practice and application of permaculture. And in that process, in the last 14 years or so, I have applied the concepts of permaculture in a lot of different kinds of settings and different types of organizations. I've founded and worked through various nonprofit organizations, mostly local to Northern California, so had some experience in that realm. Also worked on more of a international stage, bringing the solutions that permaculture and ecological design offer to the global justice movement in the early 2000s. So did quite a bit of traveling around the country and around the world where the WTO would meet or the G8 or some of these larger meta institutions that create policy for global agriculture and water. And we would come to these sites, these places, these mobilizations, and offer alternatives to privatization of our basic resources like water and seed. So that was quite a wonderful and enriching experience. And from there, I moved into starting a family and have localized my effort and started my own design contracting company called Permaculture Artisans. We're in our eighth year now, and we've done dozens and dozens and dozens of design and installations over the years. And our range is from small suburban scale homesteads all the way to multi-hundred acre broad scale land management. So my experience has come really from experience. I never ended up going to college or any kind of academia type schooling, only working with mentors, producing my own projects, and just gaining my experience on the ground.
Who have been some of your mentors and the people you've studied with over the years?
The two mentors that really got me going in this was Penny Livingston Stark and Brock Dolman. Took my first PDC from them in 1998. Penny really brought me under her wing and brought me up as a teacher. Also, Starhawk became one of my main supporters and mentors in the early 2000s. And we did a lot of the international global justice work together. And both Penny and Star have brought me up to teach PDCs. And I taught my first PDC when I was 23. And so within the sort of larger permaculture network, those are some names that people would know. Locally here in my area, I've also had just numerous mentors, organic farmers, herbalists, healers, business coaches who've just led me on my way.
It sounds like you have a really useful support network where you are in California and with the people you've had the opportunity to study with. I think when it comes to permaculture education, how important that is to be able to stand with others who have been doing this for a long time and be able to help and support one another as we move forward.
Yes, it's absolutely vital. And I've told my mentors many times over the years just how important their work with me has been. And coming to a point in my life where I'm ready to offer that kind of support to new up-and-coming permaculturists and farmers and designers. And as I start to mentor folks, I get an understanding of just how difficult real enriching mentorship can be. And it has enlightened me to understanding my mentors and their approach with me, and just gives me another sense of gratitude for, you know, being able to give me some critical feedback that might be hard to hear at times, but I think that's a really important role of a mentor, to be able to offer critical feedback in the right time and to allow us all to, you know, to grow into this work. And so at the time, it doesn't always seem valuable, you know, when your ego gets kind of knocked back or whatnot. But as you take what your mentors offer you and start applying it, you can just really see the wisdom and understand the courage it takes to be a really good mentor. So, yeah, I have real gratitude for my support network. In addition to that, I would say that my peers as well, folks who got into permaculture around the same time and folks who I've worked closely with over the years, developing new projects and working on designs and installs, we share so much with each other. And I find right now in the permaculture community and the movement as a whole, there's so much to learn from all of our peers. And if we're open to sharing with each other, in some ways I've learned more from just the people working next to me, the crew that installs my projects. It's taught me so much. And I feel that's been a real gift that permaculture has given me, is the ability to really be a learner, the ability to observe not just natural systems and understand to a certain degree how natural systems function through observation, but also technique, installation techniques, communication techniques, project management techniques. My ability to gather information through observation or seeing how other people do it really came from the permaculture lens. And that perspective is something I try to share with my students.
I can really appreciate that. I think it was David Holmgren said in our interview together that it's the idea that with permaculture, and I'm paraphrasing here, that we kind of have to be general in our understanding of permaculture while also specializing in one area, because there just is too much available to be perfect in all of it.
Exactly. It's a lifelong learning. And in some ways, I feel like if I considered myself a master at anything, I'd really be cutting off opportunity to grow and learn. And it's exciting to feel like there's so much to learn out there. you know, a lifetime's worth of knowledge and information just makes life really exciting, keeps that child curiosity alive, which I think is important as a culture for moving forward.
Though we never stop learning, so we can always move forward regardless of how young or older we are or what situation we find ourselves in. I want to talk with you more about that idea of education because of the skill center that you're working on opening, or I should say because of the permaculture skill center that you're working on opening. But before we get there, you've been running your business for, you say, 8 years now. And I'm wondering if you could share with us what it's like to get a functional, profitable permaculture design company off the ground and make a living doing this work.
That's a great question. And this is a conversation I really love to have, especially through observing the somewhat scarcity model that generally comes out of the permaculture community, just the challenges with making money at doing this work, the emotional and cultural side of it, as well as the logistical side. And as an activist for many years, I really almost hated money, as I was a self-proclaimed anti-capitalist and working hard to put a spotlight on corporate privatization issues and such. And there was a turning point for me in my mid-20s where I realized that in order for us to take permaculture to a large scale and in order for many, many more people to see it as something that's a career path, something that we can professionalize, we needed to come to terms with our relationship around money. When I started my business, it started with one project that I was able to sell to my client, that are my services, and I got one project and I was able to hire some friends. And it just kind of started that way. And that one project taught me so much. I made quite a few mistakes, which are always great learning opportunities. But one of the things I learned was that because there was an exchange, meaning my time and my friend's time for money to produce this project, we actually planted more fruit trees, developed more water harvesting systems in that one project than a whole entire 6 months of one of my previous nonprofit organizations where we were trying to fundraise and kind of working off more of a scarcity model. And what I started to realize was that money is really a representation of value, and it could represent very destructive things, but it can also represent very positive things. And nowadays, what I like to tell people is that one of my jobs is to plant money. It is essentially to offer services that have a financial exchange, a monetary exchange, and that money goes directly into planting trees, building topsoil, enhancing habitat, creating right livelihoods for my crew, my staff, and everybody involved in the project. And in my first couple of years in my business, as this realization hit home, it became very apparent to me that permaculture as a movement would benefit from a more professional representation in the business community and to use some of these business structures to our advantage to move the process of healing planet Earth and caring for humanity along much faster at the rate that is necessary for survival. So I worked through my issues around money and business, and we started to grow. And what became very apparent was that in order to professionalize, we really had to play the game right. So as I got a second project and was able to grow the business, we became licensed contractors. We started renting office space and buying equipment and getting insurance and taxes and all those things in place. And now 8 years later, we have 14 staff and a growing and budding business. And we have navigated all those sort of legal issues. And it feels really good to have found a way to professionalize this kind of work and now provide for, you know, a fair amount of people in doing it. I think something I'd like to share that I share with all my students, and this is getting very candid about some of the patterns that I see in the permaculture community especially, is folks might take a PDC, permaculture design course, and come out of it with a lot of passion and a lot of excitement and with a true yearning to create a life path, a career path, doing this kind of work. And there's not a lot of opportunities for that out there. And when we talk about the Permaculture Skill Center, we could talk more about that. But something that I like to share with folks, it's not always easy to hear, is how important it is for us to really up our game when it comes to work ethic. I feel like it may just be in the California community, but I sense it's larger than that, that although we may come with a lot of passion and knowledge, a lot of folks coming through the permaculture community may not have the greatest work ethic. And I feel it's really quite important when we're looking at professionalizing this kind of work to really do it professionally. So I think that's something that as a permaculture teachers, we can really support our students in learning how to be punctual, call people back, do what we say we're going to do. And these sorts of things will really put a new face to permaculture as a real force for change.
Being able to put the suit on and go into the office and sit down and have a meeting and meet people on their terms rather than asking them to meet us on ours.
Exactly. And the comfort level that comes with that for people who, let me put it another way, I hear often this conversation about how alternative permaculture is, or that people in the permaculture community have created some kind of exclusive group that's very hard to access. And every time I hear that, it just makes me sad that permaculture is being represented in this way. And part of it, and this is something from my own experience coming from the activist world, is I feel it's very important for us to drop our judgments about the way other people live our lives. When people take a permaculture design course, you experience such a paradigm shift in our understanding of the embodied energy of products, say, the issues around fossil fuel use and climate change, that there's a tendency to want to judge other people who aren't playing their part. And I feel we need to replace this concept of judging others with the concept of supporting them to be accountable for their actions and to transition away. So as I started to drop my judgments around people, all of a sudden I was having conversations with conservative type people, business type people who saw a professional offering services that could benefit them, potentially even financially benefit them with increased efficiency of their systems through permaculture design. And it's opened a whole new door for getting people access to these solutions, and as well for supporting people in transitioning away from destructive consumer habits and destructive land use practices.
So rather than go out and beat someone up about the decisions that they're making, you lift them up so that they can see the impact of their decisions and make a difference.
Exactly.
You're saying so many things that I regularly think about, and it's strange to hear what feels like my own thoughts being repeated back to me from someone else's words.
Well, I picked up on that when we first started talking. Like, hey, wait, I've thought about that same exact thing.
As I've moved down my permaculture path, I realize that really where I'm trying to go with sharing this information, the people that I'm trying to reach out to, is the middle 80%. And sometimes I feel that I'm kind of out in the middle of a field by myself by being like this middle road kind of person.
Well, you're not alone. And I think part of seeing this kind of shift that you're representing and what we're trying to do at the Permaculture Skills Center is realizing that there's so many people and so many folks in really important industries like agriculture and landscape, people in local government positions that really do think similar to us. They're just using a different terminology. And so one thing I found is, you know, when is the appropriate time not to use the word permaculture? To sort of understand who we're speaking to and to use a language that everyone can understand and feel comfortable with. And when we get right down to the basics of all of this, and you take political party affiliations out of it, and you take subculture issue things out of it, what we're really talking about is benefiting all people, all humanity, with the work that permaculture design and inflammation techniques offer. And it's really important to break down these barriers that make these solutions look different or alternative, because in truth, we need to normalize the idea that clean water and healthy food is important for all people to have access to. That just needs to be normalized. It's not alternative. It's not different. When it comes down to it, that's what commonality that all people could sign on to. So part of my strategy in building the movement in the way that I have and in communicating with people is really talking about the common ground and not focusing on the differences as much. And I often say to folks that here at our 5-acre permaculture skills center ranch, I want the Republican rancher, dairy farmer, to be able to feel comfortable walking on this site and learn some of our rotational grazing pasture management techniques and find value in it and not be turned off at the beginning by some cultural view.
So even though you may have a particular viewpoint about the farmer's current practices, you're not going to focus on those. You're going to focus on the common ground about if they're doing pasture-based grazing. That's the conversation that you want to have, not that necessarily because they're doing some kind of a monocrop or something else that you see that as bad.
Exactly. And if you start communicating that in terms of money, you know, and let's talk about pasture management for a second, forage quality and quantity is a very big issue for anyone grazing animals. So if we're offering solutions that will increase forage quality and quantity, right there it's an economic savings. And all that other stuff can just get put aside for a sec, all the issues and differences, and let's just talk about the economic savings about implementing a practice that manages pastures in such a way that will reduce a rancher's need to buy feed. That's a really good entrance point to then linking those practices to building soil, to habitat restoration, to infiltrating and cleaning water. All those things can really link to this conversation around increasing quality and quantity of forage, and that's sort of the entry point. And that's just one example of strategy that can be used to talk to a diversity of people and excite them about the kinds of solutions that not only will benefit them and their business, but benefit the ecosystem as a whole.
It's interesting that you talk about an entry point, because one here that we deal with is total daily load on runoff from farms. I think about how you could use that then as a starting point to have a conversation about functional riparian buffers.
Absolutely.
And again, that goes back to one of the ideas that Mollison presents in the designer's manual about how this is about collaboration and cooperation, not competition. And then how that touches on our invisible structures and about how you're talking about communication. And if we communicate poorly with someone, it's an easy way to turn them off to the path that we're on.
All it takes is that one turnoff for some people. It just takes that one turnoff, and they'll just write it off from then on. I've had folks come into some of my permaculture courses, and 3/4 of the way through, we have a conversation, similar conversation that we're having right now, about how permaculture is represented around the world. And I ask the question, I say, how many people here have been really, really turned off to permaculture prior to coming to this course? And often there's at least one or two people who have a story about someone they met, a permaculturist they met, or a class they took, where it was a very negative experience, and it was for a variety of issues, might be class issues or race issues or some of these social cultural things that really have turned people off. And the reason why they came to our course was because it was more than a permaculture course, but it was also a social organizing class. So we were able to draw from a different group in the community. But I hear people just share these stories about how turned off they were to permaculture, that they didn't even keep an openness to the potential solutions it would offer because someone communicated it in such a way that really turned them off.
I've been contacted by probably a dozen people with questions about, well, what is permaculture? I found this class here that's talking about this and this, but that doesn't jive with what I read somewhere else. I'm coming to you because I've listened to your show, and you've had
this different range of people on, including scientists who know nothing about permaculture because something that they have to say is of value to our movement. So that's why I'm here talking to you now. Can you help me clarify what this is or is not? But there's a fellow who gave me an article that I put up on the website, Andy, and it was I believe it was called All Roads Lead to Permaculture. And I think about all the different ways that people find permaculture and get here, but because the path of permaculture leads from some people have a very spiritual resonance with permaculture on one side, and then you have people on the other side of that that see permaculture as a very hardcore design science. And depending on where people fall within that spectrum, well, who they encountered as their first introduction to permaculture could completely turn them on or off to the idea.
Exactly, exactly. And hey, you know, we've all seen those YouTube videos about permaculture that may focus more on a spiritual side, and that may shut off, you know, a whole group of people even just seeing a video like that. All that being said, I attempt to just be non-judgmental on all sides of it and think that if permaculture can thread its way into spiritual communities, I think that's wonderful. But I feel like it's really, really important that we make some effort to professionalize this work. And something that I've been concerned about for the last few years is that the permaculture model doesn't have any real, tangible, economic models that people can really take on. Now, there's a lot of alternative economy stuff like LET systems and alternative currencies and things like that that have taken root in certain some communities, but it's very difficult for those to find their way into the mass at this time in our culture, at least. And so I ask myself, what can we do now to create an economic model for permaculture? Because I think when it comes down to it, everybody still needs to pay for their rent or their mortgage or their car or their bike or their student loans. We're all, for the most part, very tied in and wrapped up with the economic system that's dominating the planet right now. And I feel a good leverage point and entry point to bring permaculture to scale is to look at developing economic models that really show career paths for people. When we talk about that, now all this other stuff can kind of fall away, the alternative culture stuff, or is it spiritual or not? And let's just focus on creating career paths. Let's focus on creating right livelihood and get people. There's so many folks who take permaculture courses or people in the community that are interested in it. It's always a hobby. Oh, I do that on the weekends. You know, I'm waiting tables during the week to pay for my rent or whatnot. And we really need to flip that so that people are spending most of their time doing this work. And if we create an economic model that gets people to work where they spend 40 hours a week designing and implementing systems that are healing the planet or bettering humanity, that kind of change is one that can be rapid, accessible, and really have an impact. So that's the kind of thing we're focusing on at our new Permaculture Skill Center, is developing a model just like that. It's going to take us some time to work out all the kinks, but I'm very excited for the potential of the model we're creating.
What you just said there about how we're tied into the system, it's one of the walls that I run up against in communicating permaculture, because of the idea that permaculture is such an amazing, world-changing design system. It has the possibility to do a lot of good. So to hear that you're developing a career path for people and a model that they can use to develop some kind of economic gains that are actually part of their financial capital. So if they want to, you know, pay for a private school for their children because that meets their needs, that they can make the money to do that, is something that's very powerful to me and empowering and necessary for the next wave of permaculture to really have a mass impact.
It absolutely has to happen. I mean, it's the natural next step, and in some ways, time is running out with the global issues with climate crisis and water privatization and such, that there's a sense of urgency to bring solutions to scale. And I am so appreciative and I admire people who are able to live off the grid and live out in the woods and not be so tied into the economic system. I think that that's a valuable model, and I admire the courage and the hard work that people do to create that kind of life for themselves. But I'm really about being practical and tangible in how I use my energy. And I think if we're looking at turning the herd, so to speak, if we're looking at how do we implement mass solutions to potentially save humanity, potentially save planet Earth, if we're looking at the scale that is upon us, then the strategy is, well, what are the tools that we have to use right now to take permaculture to scale? And one of the tools that we have to use is economics. And it may be one of our more powerful tools in the near term. And I'm all for deconstructing capitalism in the long term. But for right now, if we want to be successful, if we want to have a massive change, it's important that we put aside our judgment around how other people are living their lives and get the solutions to them, get the career paths to them, get people spending their time, all of their time, doing this kind of work. And it's just not going to happen if there's not a financial incentive to do so. And I'm very critical about the fact that generally permaculture education is not very affordable to a wide diversity of people. And I think that partially the reason why that's happened is because we haven't really been applying the principles and design practice of permaculture to developing these economic systems. And if we start thinking of it like a design project, I think we can find ways to make permaculture education very, very affordable if we tie it to micro-enterprise industries that are producing products and services for the community that have an educational or vocation overlay to them, so that you get people a high level of job training and permaculture design and implementation training, while at the same time they're working within industries that are actually producing some kind of economic return. And that's the edge that really gets exciting to me, is I think we can pull it off. We can actually create career paths in this work and make the education really affordable to a wide diversity of people.
So from the sound of that, then, you're trying to add additional value to permaculture education beyond just the 72-hour high, come take a class, here's a certificate, go out into the world and do good?
Yeah, especially here in Northern California, we have a lot of organizations that are putting on stellar permaculture design courses, and I teach parts of all those courses and I'm very networked in with all those organizations. And so I think what we're developing at the Permaculture Skill Center is very intentionally different than what our colleagues are doing. And it's the intention is to supplement those design courses, those intro courses, and that more concept pathway that people take when they're getting more into the concepts of permaculture. And being a landscape contractor for 8 years, and prior to that, just being someone who has a strong work ethic, I'm much more about getting people to work. You know, I would rather spend half a day taking apart a whole irrigation manifold and putting it back together with a class than to sit and talk about how to use a drip irrigation system on your farm or whatnot. So I'm really excited about the opportunities of giving people real tools, which it doesn't have to be called permaculture. It might be called plumbing skills, you know, carpentry skills. There's a lot of skilled people in the community to learn from. So even our mentors that we can bring in for these classes and trainings don't have to be permaculturists. They can be just contractors, people in the trades who have a high level of consciousness around the kind of work that they perform and the ecological impact it has. And it's really linking up permaculturists with these people and really great business people, entrepreneurs who also are thinking a lot about ecological regeneration, could be really, really valuable mentors for folks who want to create a career path in permaculture. So I'm really into empowering people with tangible tools that make them hireable in their community and or support them in starting their own businesses.
How does that then translate to the work that you want to do with the Permaculture Skill Center?
Great question. So we are actually developing this program right now here at the Permaculture Skill Center. It's this site. It's here in Sebastopol, California. It's a 5-acre site. and it's on a busy highway. So we specifically bought a property that is on a highway with very easy access to a diversity of people. And we are creating vocational training programs here, just like I've been describing to you. And part of the vocational training programs we're creating are tied into the ag-related micro-enterprises that we're developing here on the farm, like a CSA and a UPIC strawberry patch. And we have a fiber project going on with alpacas and sheep. So we have a variety of micro-enterprises we're developing here. And our students will essentially be running these micro-enterprises. And by doing that, it makes the class very much more affordable because there's a product on the back end that generates revenue. So for a percentage of our students, we can offer, you know, free or work trade or scholarships. And we'll be really focusing on vocations and hands-on type of work and spending less time in, you know, lecture or conceptual format and really focus in on skills. We're developing this right now. And in 2 weeks, on June 15th, we're having our official kickoff. We've owned the property for about a year and developing this model for the last year. And we're just about ready to unveil it to the community. And our goal is that in 5 years, we will have worked out the kinks and put together a model that can be replicated throughout the country as an actual model that could be tied to other kinds of permaculture education like the PDC.
And is that something then that you plan to offer to the community once you have the kinks worked out, that you can give them kind of a roadmap for how they can get things started?
Absolutely. That's a really a large goal of ours, is to develop this pilot program and to really get it all figured out and then share it in mass and support others in developing the same kind of model. And we have a lot to learn. So what the model will be in the next 5 years is probably going to be very different than what we're envisioning right now, because as I've learned through experience, once you hit the ground and start getting to work, things change. And so I'm inviting and open to how this process is going to teach us what's really needed. You know, what are the skills that people really need to create a career path in this way? What are the kinds of mentors and the kind of mentorship program that is going to be really valuable for people to create some kind of job path for themselves? So that's going to be our learning over the next few years. And we're really excited about it.
Going through this process, it allows you to make the economic gains that are necessary to be sufficient to meet your needs, while also in a way kind of subsidizing both the education that you're doing and the material that you release for free to the public?
Yes. You know, once we start applying permaculture design to these kinds of systems, they get really complicated really fast, because there's so many functions to stack and so many linking relationships between things. But so far, what we're developing is not only our educational, our vocational programs tied to the on-site ag-related micro-enterprises, but also we're finding ways to link to existing businesses out in the community to create internship programs where interns from our programs can work with other businesses and learn the ropes and support other companies in doing, you know, the right thing. And that way, the other value that people get is they will be networked in the community. By the time they complete one of our programs, they'll already have potential leads for jobs, they'll have networks to rely on, and people to go to. So what's really important about this, and where I feel a lot of our existing permaculture education models in some ways can drop the ball, is, you know, you take a PDC and you go out into the world and then you don't feel held anymore. And we want to really create a system that once you've made it through our program, you are completely tied into the right network that will see you successful. So that takes a lot of outreach to existing businesses and people in the community and get buy-in from them. And we need to find incentives and ways to encourage other businesses to see the value of being connected into our program. And I think this is the kind of design plan that can allow it to be replicable, because every community is different. And so what we do here, the exact micro enterprises that we perform here may not be applicable in other regions, but the model of weaving relationships with the things that are applicable in the companies and individuals in any community that are applicable, that kind of model can be very replicable. I'm still working out my sound bites on all of this, because it's a fairly complex model that we're creating. And so it's very difficult to put it into, you know, two sentences, but we're getting there.
Quite all right. I come from a very technical background where I'm used to starting at 30,000 feet with a big overview and then breaking things down until you get to the bottom. I'm just taking this, I'm taking bits and pieces and reassembling them in my head to put them together in the way that I think. I'm listening to what you're saying, and it makes me think, well, you're doing something in Northern California that I'm trying to accomplish in an online environment, because you're using your knowledge and skill set and the network that you're tied into to create this very productive, functional, educational path for people, whereas I'm kind of doing the mirror of that by using my own skills and my own specialties to do a very similar thing. It again makes me feel like I'm not alone in what I'm doing.
Yes, and it's a both and we need to approach this shift in how we bring permaculture to the world from these different angles. I mean, you're reaching thousands and thousands of people with the work that you're doing, and the work that we're doing will hopefully create dozens and hundreds and over the of people who have real tangible skills that they can go out in the community and be of service and be hireable.
And by having this conversation and being candid with one another, at the same time, we're also collaborating by getting to know one another in a way that we could network and use the relationship that's just developed in this interview process to aid one another in the future and also our students moving forward.
Let's do it. I'm game.
I think that that's one of the really powerful things, though, about permaculture, as you get into the mindset and you go through those ethics. And I know that the third ethic is one that's very, I don't want to say that it's troubling, but it's kind of a hot button issue for some people. What does it mean to share the surplus? Or, you know, the idea of limiting population and consumption, the various ways that that third ethic winds up becoming iterated to people.
Well, I was just going to say, it's good that it's a hot button issue, I think. I think it's important that that third ethic can bring up a very important conversation. And it's okay that there's these different perspectives about permaculture, like, say, the more purist kind of form of just being out of the consumerist capitalist system completely and such. There's a place for that. And I think that the reason why it's a hot button issue and the reason why that third ethic can bring up so much is because we really haven't put a lot of time into developing the models that will see that third ethic successful. It's a gray area for a lot of folks because we're so stuck in this large consumerist society, and we're looking for avenues to pull out or to change. And it's a very difficult thing to change. It's steeped into the global community, and it's not something that can change overnight. So we're all having these discussions and debates about, well, how do you share surplus, and what is fair share, and fair share for who, and all the issues that come up with that. To me, it's like applying the principle of the problem is the solution in permaculture. And it's like, okay, this issue, this problem that we're having, figuring out fair share, that's an indicator that there's something missing in the system. And the system I'm talking about is the permaculture concept, the permaculture idea. There's something missing in there. And that is very tangible models related to fair share and very tangible models that address surplus. And so in a way, there's a niche to be filled there for permaculturists who are courageous enough and have the energy to take on these issues and start developing real models that can touch on all the different issues that people have around that. I think class and race and accessibility are issues we need to be talking about and addressing in how we develop a permaculture movement going forward. And they're very difficult conversations to have, and it's very emotional, but we need to have them, and we need to work our way through, find the common ground, and really push forward with solutions. So I try to keep in that mindset of solutions. Let's inform ourselves about the issues. Let's be aware. Let's practice what we preach in a way. But let's also not get too bogged down in the debate. Let's take the important points, and then let's really look towards designing solutions towards them. And I really invite not just the permaculture community, but anyone who's concerned about social justice, equality, environmental destruction, anyone who is concerned about any of these large-scale issues that plague our society and our earth, to start working on real, tangible solutions that could be implemented today. Because it's one thing to focus all our time on alternatives that might be applicable in 20, 30, 40 years, but you know, I have a 5-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter, and for me, I feel very inspired and almost pushed to start creating some real tangible solutions that can be implemented today. In today's climate, in today's culture, in today's economy. Otherwise, it feels like a very bleak future.
I can totally understand that. Because I think about choices around food and how when you do a family budget and look at the amount of money that you spend on food, that's an easy place to look at and say, well, I can cut some money out of my food budget by making a particular choice. But if you look at that and you go, well, let's look at the decisions that you're making and say, because we want to support local economies, well, maybe that does mean that 80% of your food is bought at the big box store, because that's what allows you to free up enough money because of the low cost that you're paying there to then go to your local farmer's market and buy their pasture-raised meat that's more per pound, but you're actually putting that money into the local economy and getting to know that farmer, which is a choice that you might not have been able to make if you're trying to feed your family on a particular budget without knowing where you can free up money within the budget you have rather than cutting that budget. Again, meeting people where they're at and helping them make better decisions that improve their lives rather than asking them to radically change their lives immediately.
Exactly. It's that entry point again. And it's also part of just realizing that we are in a transitionary time right now. This just reminds me of, I've always been a bit of a visionary. I'm always thinking up new things and trying to get them off the ground. And for years, I would come up with these visions. And I would work so hard to accomplish it. And when the year's done, I feel, you know, like a failure because I didn't accomplish my vision in that year. And over time, through experience, what I realized is that one thing that we miss a lot in our culture is to be able to look at long-term strategy. We're so much about short-term gain these days, and especially with how ramped up everyone is with all the new technology. And what I've learned now is that to really see solutions take root, it's important to see what is the realistic time frame to accomplish a certain vision. And if, let's say, the vision or the goal is a massive divestment from fossil fuels, let's say, or a radical shift in where people buy their food, that, okay, maybe there's a realistic time frame there for, say, a family, like your example, to move their consumption of food to only local sources. But that may be difficult for them in the first couple of years because of financial issues or the lack of access or whatnot. And so what are those transitions, like the example you brought up, that can help people start moving towards that goal? And as we know, through observing natural systems, there's always a succession. And so we have to ask ourselves, where are we in the succession? And if you try to move an ecosystem too fast in its successional pattern, you're going to end up with failure because you didn't build a strong enough foundation. So even in our approach to bringing these solutions to the masses, it's very important to allow people to have that transition time and start to build that foundation of trust and collaboration and not let it get polluted by judgment and fear, and really draw people in to where they can make a change and where they can make a shift. And then that's an entry point to start introducing people to the next thing. And that lifestyle change can happen over time in a realistic time frame. Otherwise, we're going to lose people if you try to push people too fast. Now, at the same time, there is a real sense of urgency, too, because of climate crisis and whatnot. So my perspective is, let's be realistic. We're not going to change everybody's lifestyle next year, but let's implement solutions that'll draw people in now. You know, let's spend time now meeting people where they're at, because if we wait, the shift isn't going to happen fast enough. It's standing on a knife edge in a way, drawing people in quickly and creating solutions that can go to scale fast, while at the same time understanding how culture works and culture change works, and having the appropriate approach to that kind of culture change.
And as you say about putting together your permaculture skills center, it's a big, complex system, and we can only put so much of it together at a time and get it all to work and make sense.
Exactly. And 4 years ago, I started brewing up this vision and having many conversations with colleagues and friends and mentors about the kinds of models and solutions that would bring permaculture to scale, that would professionalize these solutions. And that was 4 years ago that the idea was seeded. And so it took us 4 years to get to a place in our lives and to make the right connections for the financing and all of that to then actually buy the property and now initiate the project. And it's going to take us a few more years to actually get the programs really worked out. And that's okay. It's that kind of long-term planning and thinking that will see these projects be successful. And so I just want to encourage everyone to think about what's the appropriate time frame for the kinds of wonderful ideas that people might be having. And I always tell everybody, it's never the case that an idea isn't possible. The question is, when is it possible? And if it takes 20 years, that's okay. Because if you can see things in a realistic time frame, then you won't get discouraged, because each step you take is a step towards your goal, and you can feel really good about that.
And the nice thing about that is that you've put a plan in place as you move forward. You can look back and see what did get done, rather than focusing on what didn't get done or what's yet to be done, and then get the confidence of those small successes.
Exactly. It's kind of a psychological trick on yourself to be able to put that kind of long-term planning into place. And so I would ask the community, well, where do we want to be in 10 years? That's almost more of the question, is where do we want to be in 10 years? And as we start visioning that and projecting out, now we can start taking real steps to get there. If we're trying to accomplish a 10-year plan next year, then we're just going to feel failure and then get discouraged.
We can't try to push too hard and do everything at once. We have to be realistic about what we can and can't get done.
Burnout is a very real phenomenon. I've experienced it.
Going to say, it's why I left my old career. I completely understand it. But I've had you here for quite some time now. This is going to edit up into a pretty nice episode. Do you have any last thoughts for the listeners before we bring this to a close?
My thoughts would be this. The solutions, although they seem complex, they in many ways are embarrassingly simple. And if we can just get out of our own way, because in many ways we're keeping ourselves back, if we could get out of our own way and find ways to collaborate with many, many, many different types of people, not just people you share the same value with, not just people in your subculture community, but if we can find those threads of connections to different kinds of people in all sorts of various industries, look for the common ground and offer up solutions where it's appropriate, I feel we'll have great success in starting to move some of our solutions to the scale that it really needs to be.
Well, thank you for those final thoughts, Mr. Olson. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
It's been a real pleasure.
And that was Eric Olson. Some points about this conversation that stand out were the role of mentors and experience in our search for knowledge and skills. Those people we connect with provide voices that shape the direction where we go with our personal practice. I can't speak for Eric, His own words do that well enough. But I'm deeply thankful for Ben Wise and Dylan Cruz for guiding me through the formal training of a PDC. As one of their first PDC students, as I watch my own understanding grow, it's interesting to go back and sit in on a class with Ben and see how his styles and methods have changed since those early days, and how our divergent paths help to inform the place where I work from, going back and seeing the work that he's doing now. From that first experience came my teacher training with Jude Hobbs, Andrew Millison, and Rico Zook. Each one of them I've been in touch with since then, and our relationships change from that teacher-student paradigm and become more and more one of permaculture colleagues. The confidence that instills in me that my former instructors welcome me as an equal, yet still offer their encouragement for the work that I do, is invaluable. Looking beyond the people in the permaculture community, as Eric noted in the interview, there are other places to find mentoring. I have several family members who continue to teach me about home repair and maintenance, even though I grew up in a place where it was assumed that I would just work a job and be able to pay others to do that. I'm thankful that I'm getting to learn from them now to be able to take a more hands-on approach to my home and environment, and the way that I can relay those skills to the other work that I do. Learning how to swing a hammer, to cut lumber to proper dimensions, and to build things, ranging from garden boxes to closet shelves, go a long way towards that reskilling necessary to relocalize our community. And I also have my friend John, who's another craftsman and a maker who will, with a warm spirit, answer my questions about energy, electronics, and engineering, even when we're tired from hours of martial arts practice or sitting down over a pint when we're supposed to be socializing. And because of his patience with me, I get a better understanding of these ideas and can use my role as an instructor to relay them more plainly to others. Taking the time to reflect, or you might say, observing and interacting, on my life experiences provide many, many places where I can gain knowledge and skills applicable to permaculture practice. I think this is important so we can find our personal niche in all of this and become a jack of all trades and master of one. And that's where I liked Eric's personal story, because it shows an example built on experience, not on formal schooling, though he certainly had plenty of educational opportunities through his various mentors. Though I have a personal bias towards academia, because of the way that I see the credentials it provides as a societal shortcut towards acceptance, plus I'll admit that I was one of those kids who really liked school, I do recognize that schooling isn't a path for everyone. Those formal walls, that sitting at a desk and books and things, isn't appropriate for each individual. And more time in school is useless unless you found a calling that allows you to devote yourself to the work, to turn the school experience into a true education. As I'm discovering on my repeated passes through college now at the graduate level, I think that we're ultimately the ones responsible for our own education, whether it's inside or outside of a classroom. And as Stephen Herod Buhner pointed out, that there is a distinction between schooling and education. Choosing an experiential route is just as worthwhile as an academic one if you're ready to put in the equally hard work to make a name for yourself, especially in the West, where it can take a number of years to build up a good reputation to make a living at what you're doing. Going out on your own, even when supported by like-minded individuals, isn't the easiest road to follow. You'll be doing a lot of personal bushwhacking and brush clearing to find the paths that intersect and run parallel to your own, but you can do it. Eric and others like him in the world provide inspiration, as well as help to show you that finding your own way is possible. And even if you do choose the schooling route and the pieces of paper that come with them, you'll still need the experience to back it up by being out there and doing the work so you can show people what you're capable of. Regardless of which path you choose, I'll be here with you throughout your journey. If you ever need a few words of encouragement or have questions about the work that you're doing or the path that you're on, feel free to contact me. You can do so through the Facebook page, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or you can just search The Permaculture Podcast if you're already logged in, on Twitter, @permaculturecst, or for me, the more traditional routes, email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266. And that brings the interview section of the show to a close. Now for a few updates. Next week, on July 9th, will be Josh Trott of D Acres talking about his work. And July 16th is Nikki Jabor, author of The Year-Round Vegetable Gardener. And the interviews are complete from my conversations with Arthur Haynes, Larry Korn, and Ann Stone, so expect those in the coming weeks. The online PDC also started July 1st, and thank you to everyone who signed up. We have an interesting year ahead of us, full of plenty of teaching and learning moments. And all of that brings this episode to a close. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And now the legal. This show is released under Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share this with whoever you want. Just tell them where you got it from. Don't change it or try to sell it.